jury's like, oh, snap, a twist. Like, they love twists. Any great trial has a twist.
I suggest that we give him 10 years in Leavenworth or 11 years in Swellworth.
I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll take 5 and 10 in Woolworth.
Like this, Mr. Court.
Address the judge as your honor.
Well, it was like this, my honor.
Your honor, not my honor.
Why? Don't you like him?
You're meant to come down here and defend me against these characters, and the only one I've got on my side is the blood-sucking lawyer.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 311. Ooh, 311. Isn't that something? Or am I thinking 41? Or, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, all the things that end in 11, I think, are actual things. 311 is that non-emergency police?
Maybe that's it. Yeah. Well, that's good for this. This is a non-emergency, but still very important. I've taken my opioid.
This is a 311 episode. Yeah.
I'm Thomas Smith. That over there is Andrew Torres. How are you doing, Andrew?
I am fantastic. I'm extra fantastic since we got to do a numerology intro. So those are the best.
Yeah. I've slipped my opioids as you told me to do. We're talking opioids today. Finally, we're also going to talk about the Mann Act and Epstein. That's something we wanted to cover before, but it got pushed off because there's too much important news, but it's a very worthwhile question for Andrew to answer. And also, like I said, opioids, that big ruling, big settlement. And I think it seems to me that it's actually big, not like, oh, that seems like a big number, but it's, you know, 4 minutes worth of income. This one seemed actually big to me. So we'll see if Andrew agrees. And then finally, we got a little follow up on people crunching the numbers on what we should expect statistically from court decisions, Supreme Court decisions. So that was interesting. We can talk a little bit about that. Well, that's our agenda. Before we do that, do you have any announcements?
Thomas, I also wanted to talk about the September 12th Democratic debate, the criteria doubled.
Oh, boy, am I looking forward to it now. I wasn't, because there was going to be an 11th candidate. I forget who it is. I'm blanking on it. But somebody was like right on the verge, and they were thinking like, oh, the poll will be released that will get them onto the stage. And if they had 11, I cannot believe this. But if they had 11, they were going to do two nights and do a 6 and 5. They wouldn't have just smashed in another podium or maybe just set up a little like folding table to the side and been like, all right, you can be in on this one, which would have been way better and more inappropriate too, to like kind of be demeaning about it. But like,
them to do 6 and 5 or 5.
I would like to
have two nights each with 5 candidates on the stage, get, you know, a little more in depth. I feel like 10, it's just, you know,
look,
it's hard
I agree
to stand
that 10
out.
Isn't great, but 2 fives is also awful because you got the problem is you have to repeat territory. So like the moderators, there's 2 possibilities. Either you ask them all the same questions, which you don't want, because it's like if the public is going to watch 2 debates. And by the way, if they had 2, one of them would have been on a Friday night, would have been Thursday, Friday. No one would have watched the Friday night one. So, yeah, I mean, it's a disaster all around, I think. It's way better to have 1. But if you have 2, they can't help but like react to each other. So like, then that kind of is unfair to the first night, you know, like that they got to the second night gets to react and have different answers. I don't know. Either way you do it, it's going to be terrible. And also, I'm tired of not having Elizabeth Warren interacting with, you know, Biden or whatever. Like, we need to get them all on one stage, I think.
I agree with that, but I would just do that by doing what the Republicans did and have top
the
5 candidates go Thursday night and have the JV table on Friday night.
I agree. Well, the JV should be like Wednesday at noon. I'm like, just nobody even, whatever.
Friday night is pretty bad. Yeah. I mean, you know, that's not a great time for folks wanting to sit down and curl up with
which is crazy to me. I'm so much different than the average American, because when I was like, what was the problem with Friday night? That sounds great. I'd love to just crack open a cold one or a bottle of wine. Have a little date night with a wife and watch a debate. That sounds fantastic to me.
I would be, inching my way towards the two of you on that couch. That sounds like a lot of fun.
Anytime. It's a good thing we don't live anywhere near each other, because I'm sure my wife would be like, hey, wasn't this our date night? And then Andrew would be there in the middle. I'll be like, no, this was always the plan.
This is spectacular, guys. I'm having fun. You guys having fun?
Yeah, right. You'd cook us one of your amazing dinners, and you could just move in. It would be fine.
There we go. All right. I suspect, because I think you and I feel similarly. I liked the campaign that Kirsten Gillibrand ran.
Yeah.
I thought she was good in both debates, but she failed to break through. And so she didn't qualify for the second one and dropped out. And that is the responsible adult thing to do. Anybody that didn't qualify for the second debate who stays in is staying in on vanity, greed, ego.
Yeah, no kidding.
I don't get it.
What do you think's going to happen? Like, after not being on the one stage that all the serious candidates are on, then I'll really get my push afterward.
And again, this threshold is not a big threshold. This is 130,000 unique donors and 2% in four separate polls. I wouldn't get 130,000 donor, right?
Yeah.
But
you only got a couple thousand patrons.
Yeah. If we get 130,000 patrons, I will get to join them on the stage. That would be fantastic. Yeah. Julian Castro and Andrew Yang qualified.
I was
going to
say
this.
That. Yeah. And I'm glad, too, by the way, that Julian Castro is qualified. That's an example of somebody who really, I think he's maybe the only person who really gained, like took the opportunity in a debate to make the case and launch himself into that next echelon, that upper echelon of candidate. I don't know that he's, going to win or anything, but, he went from zero to in this debate, which is cool.
Yeah. I think that's right. That's the way the process is supposed to work. So, personally, I'm disappointed to see Gillibrand go. That's what you do at this point. And, the idea of having a continuing winnowing process, if we get down to five or six by the next one, that would be ideal.
That'd be so great. It'd be such a relief.
Yeah,
you have to just hear the people that actually have a chance debate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And look, this is, I've been saying for a very long time, polls don't matter. It's early. September, the year before the primaries, that's when polls start mattering. That's when things start being predictive. Now, that does not mean there isn't, tremendous room to move around. But this was the time in 2015 when people started taking Trump seriously. I mean, nobody's ever taken Trump seriously.
Did we take him literally, but not seriously?
Right. This time in 2003 was when Howard Dean went from 1% to 35%, right?
Wow, what a jump.
I've mentioned that quite a bit. And again, Dean didn't get the nomination. He collapsed right before Iowa. But this is the time where we start going from it being just name recognition and people are starting to kind of dial in and focus. And the social science literature says that it matters. So, to me, and again, probably going to lose patrons over that, right? Like, it seems pretty obvious to me that you have four candidates who can realistically get the nomination at this point, right? You have Biden, Sanders, Warren, and Kamala Harris. I don't see a path for anyone else. You want to put Pete Buttigieg in there? It looks like he sort of peaked early and is fading, but fine if you squint. I think everybody else who's still on that stage either falls into the category of Andrew Yang, who is running on an issue, UBI, which we will discuss on the show, or is running for vice president, right? And you can see the appeal of, right, an Amy Klobuchar, Cory Booker, Beto O'Rourke, Julian Castro. Those are four very, very plausible. And Pete Buttigieg, I would put in the vice presidential pool. But, you know, again, I'm going to lose listeners over that. And I want to have Pete on the show. We've tried to reach out to a couple of channels. He's done.
I feel like we could almost get Yang. Like, he's, because he just does everything, you know? Like, yeah. We should have gone for that. But I don't know.
All right. Well, I'll reach out to Yang, too. Yeah.
You know, it's interesting because
Pete's done podcasts smaller than ours. So, you know, we should.
Okay. Well, yeah, we should get him. We could talk about his version. I'd love to talk about his version of Christianity and all that stuff. It's really interesting.
Yeah.
That'd be great. You know, it's interesting because at the same time, I do wish we could just hear from those four candidates. And also, Andrew, I appreciate we get to do a little punditry here. This is fun. I don't normally do it. But anyway, I also really want Julian Castro on the stage just for what he adds to the conversation, you know, and I would put, I don't know, I would put Booker actually a little bit in that category personally. Whereas someone like Beto, I don't feel like he adds anything that I haven't heard somewhere, or Klobuchar just says, hey, I'm a moderate, and so vote for me. You know, and so I kind of wish it was smaller, but I also see the value that some of these candidates, even though they don't likely have any chance, I like what they're adding to the conversation. Because I agree with you.
Yeah. No, go ahead. Finish.
Well, I was going to say, I suppose Kamala Harris would be the one non-white candidate of the four that you talked about who are the top four. But she also has some stances that have been in the past a little more conservative on things like, criminal justice and all that, in a way that I think that Julian Castro and Booker are a nice counterweight to that I appreciate on the stage. So anyway, that's what I'm looking forward to.
I agree with that. I'm looking forward to it. And then I assume you will do your usual fantastic job of covering the debate on SIO.
Well, yeah. And Jamie over there, if anyone hasn't checked it out, I've been working with co-host Jamie Lombardi recently, who's a philosopher and has a doctorate, teaches philosophy, has been a lot of fun. She's really great. And she's been really looking forward to jumping on for a debate episode once that comes up. So she keeps telling every time I'm like, what should we cover? She's like, oh, there's the debate. I'm like, yeah, it's in September. Like, she's really chomping at the bit for that one. I can't wait.
Excellent. Excellent.
All right. Well, that aside, it's time to get to the show. That was fun. Down the law, breaking down the law, breaking down the law, breaking down the law. Let's talk about this Mann Act and why Epstein was not charged under it. This, am I correct in saying that this has been a little bit of a conspiracy theory related thing? Okay.
Yep. Absolutely. What's conspiracy theory related thing.
Let me put on my tinfoil hat.
Yeah. Well, and
Joe
and
Rogan
first,
this right into my brain.
Yeah. Well, first, it's all moot now because the indictment against Epstein in the Southern District of New York has been null prost, right? That is null prosequi, which is Latin for we're not doing anything with this. Mm-hmm. And that's because he's dead. It's, you know, we tend not to proceed to, you know, criminal verdict against dead people.
But I have been really wondering about that, though, because like, how does, I don't know if you're going to explain this or if it, apologies if it's not what you want to talk about at all, but like, I have been wondering, you know, if I'm potentially liable to somebody, let's say I've wronged them in some way and they could get a bunch of money from me potentially, but then I just kill myself. Is my money like then safe? Like it's in my family, you know, like is there a way for victims to still get restitution? Or once you off yourself, then you're everything's safe.
Oh, no. So civil lawsuits can proceed against the defendant's estate.
All right. I see. Yeah.
So, yeah, it's just the criminal proceeding. Gotcha. So this is a really good illustration, and it's much better, right? Like, because as we saw, for example, most famous celebrity, in history, in recent history, in terms of legal proceedings, right? The O.J. Simpson trial.
Department of Justice.
Criminally. Yeah. Right. Criminally not guilty, civilly definitely liable. And that's that will continue. Those cases, those civil cases, gotcha. Will continue okay. against Epstein. So, but yeah, back pre-Epstein's suicide, which, again, I feel like we had a little bit of a bubble, conspiracy bubble of, you know, was there a hit and was it inconsistent? And I think now, like, you know, we've sort of come around to, no, just, you know, relatively well, old dude, like, hung himself in prison.
You and I certainly feel that way, and I think a lot of people listening might, but I also think there's a gigantic number of people in America who just take it for granted that he was killed. Like, I want to see the numbers, actually. I'd be curious if they've done any polling on it.
Me too. Yeah. Send that if you've got the numbers, if you're a listener. But so this question was, isn't it suspicious that Jeffrey Epstein was not charged under the Mann Act? And so in answering that, I thought I would take a little bit of a trip down nostalgia lane and talk about what the Mann Act is.
That sounds like a great Tuesday deep dive. Let's do it.
So the Mann Act was originally called the White Slave Traffic Act. Put a pin in that and be happy that it's not 1910 anymore. In its original form, it made it a felony to engage in the interstate or foreign commerce transport of, quote, any woman or girl for the purpose of prostitution or debauchery or for any other immoral purpose. And if you're a good originalist, you might be looking at that going, OK, I get prostitution. Not 100% certain on debauchery. That seems like that's a term that's kind of going out of fashion. But what does any other immoral purpose mean? Right. Again, remember, this thing is called the White Slave Traffic Act. Right. So, you know, you'd think it should be a criminal thing. Well, to explain what any other immoral purpose is, we look to a case called Caminiti versus United States, 1917 case. So it only took it took a year for the Supreme Court to rule. So, you know, it only took about 6 years for prosecutors to invoke the Mann Act in this situation. And you might be able to guess where I'm going. This is two married guys who lived in your neck of the woods, Thomas, Sacramento, California.
Oh, cool.
They decided they were going to travel a road trip. It's 1916, so you know, I don't know, Model T with the top down or something.
Half of all people who traveled in road trips died back then, but that's okay.
they died of dysentery. It's a reverse Oregon Trail. They were going from Sacramento to Reno with their girlfriends, and you know, they
sounds debaucherous to my 1910 ears.
Yeah, and it also did to their wives, who found out about this road trip. You know, it was I'm just trying to envision the like old timey, like Bob and I are we're headed out to Reno for fantasy football draft. So wives found out and told the police, and these guys were arrested in Reno and convicted under the Mann Act because they were transporting women or girls, namely their girlfriends, across state lines from California into Nevada for any other immoral purpose. And in this case, the immoral purpose was to have, you know, consensual sexual relationship outside of their marriage. And this case made it up to the Supreme Court because this, you know, there was nothing else going on in the United States in 1917. World War One, the collapse of the czar, you know. The Supreme Court said, affirmed the convictions. They said any other immoral purpose included consensual extramarital affairs. Do you remember I told you to put a pin in the whole White Slave Traffic Act bit? The Supreme Court said, look, that's not the immoral purpose that Congress meant. So this actually becomes one of the very first textualist decisions of the Supreme Court, right? Like they're saying, look, any other immoral must mean any other immoral. Let's not pretend that we know what the legislature, which, by the way, this is only 7 years later, right? Like, it's not hard to ask them or, yeah, you know, look at their contemporaneous record.
That's some broad catch-all language, though. Doesn't that essentially give you license to legislate morality of any kind that you feel like? I mean, any immoral purpose? Are they going to, you know, like, try to gamble, try to do anything that they feel they're going to drink, or they're going to do anything that somebody feels is immoral? Doesn't that... kind of broad, isn't it?
I think, and you're right. So let me read the language the Supreme Court uses, and then I think your implicit criticism is they're going to use this broad language, but even then they don't really mean it, right? So here's what the Supreme Court says. It says, where the language is plain, it admits of no more than one meaning, the duty of interpretation, you know, to look at what the Congress thought, does not arise, and the rules which are to aid doubtful meanings need no discussion. There is no ambiguity in the terms of this act. It is specifically made an offense to knowingly transport in interstate commerce any woman or girl for the purpose of prostitution or debauchery, or for, quote, any other immoral purpose, or with the intent and purpose to induce any such woman to engage in
any other immoral practice. So, like, I'm going to take a friend of mine, and we're going to go jaywalk in Vegas.
Yep.
So I'm going to be convicted of the Mann Act.
And under the plain meaning of what the court says in Caminiti, that would apply. Under reality, if the Caminiti court, if we time travel back to 1917, you look at this decision and you're like, all right, I'm going to test this law. I'm going to transport a woman across state lines for the purpose of encouraging her to jaywalk. There is 100% certainty that the Supreme Court would say, well, okay, for any other immoral purpose is in a clause, right? It's in a list of three things where the first two things are prostitution and debauchery, right? Those refer to sexual conduct. So it means any other immoral sexual purpose. They just didn't, you know, right? That's what I am as certain as I am of anything on earth that's how the Supreme Court would come out. But notice, right, and this is why your criticism is dead on, and this is reason number 11,406 why textualism is nonsense. Notice that if the Supreme Court is to be believed, right, I just read you the passage. They said, nope, we don't use any canons of statutory construction here because the meaning is plain from the language. And your point, supremely well taken. There is no such thing as a Supreme Court case in which the meaning of the statute is 100% clear. I feel very comfortable saying that. Are there things in which it's completely clear? Yeah, it's completely clear when it says the speed limit is 55, right? But even then, right, all of our listeners understand the, like, you can go 57 when it says 55, right? Mm-hmm. And I cannot think of a single bright line. Oh, here's a bright line that we can enforce, right? You must be 18 years old to vote, right? Now, notice again that there are exceptions to that, right? Like, states have allowed 17-year-olds to vote in primaries if they're going to be 18 at the time of the general. But assume we can still pick a number, right, and figure out, right, it's 2 days shy of your 18th birthday on election day 2020. You don't get to vote. That is, there's zero ambiguity. That's correct. That case doesn't get to the Supreme Court because there's zero ambiguity, right?
Right.
That case is 100% shut, you know, open and shut. This is something that you learn really on day one of law school, which is that there are no, you can divide, and we've talked about this. We talked about this in the White House brief. You can divide things into easy and hard cases or political and apolitical cases. But by the time, even if it's 9-0, even if the court comes down in a way that is decisive, there's no such thing as an easy case like the you have to be 18 to vote. You have to drive 55 at the Supreme Court. All of these hit the Supreme Court because there's some ambiguity, because there's some tension between what the law says and what the law means. And that's kind of why I wanted to have this this discussion about the, you know, crazy interpretation of the Mann Act in 1917. I can tell you that because of this decision, and, you know, wouldn't be an OA segment if I didn't depress the hell out of people, the Mann Act has been shamefully used in our nation's history against what used to be called miscegenation.
Right.
African Americans, usually black men transporting white women across state lines. Today, the Mann Act is codified at 18 U.S.C. 2423A, and the women or girls bit and the immoral purpose bit has been brought into the 21st century, and it now says a person knowingly transports an individual who has not attained the age of 18 years in interstate or foreign commerce or in any commonwealth, territory, or possession of the U.S. with intent that they engage in prostitution or in any sexual activity for which a person can be charged with a criminal offense shall be fined under this title and imprisoned not less than 10 years or for life.
Well, that doesn't 24. Sound, that sounds good, though. Yeah. That's like a yep. maybe stop human trafficking, stop, you yep. know, kind of.
And 2421 does not repeats that language for any person, right? So I want to say the Mann Act by its terms, right, that this the Caminiti, like, you know, carousing guys, you know, step out on their wives with their girlfriends on a trip in a state in which adultery is illegal, like New York, for example, the Mann Act could technically still apply.
But it said under 18, right?
No, that's 2423 is under 18.
Oh, sorry.
2421 gotcha. Is any individual.
Anyone. Okay.
Yep. So you could technically still prosecute someone if they take their girlfriend to New York, if it they engage in any sexual activity for which a person can be charged with a criminal offense. And adultery is a criminal offense in the state of New York. So there's the Mann Act, and it is... I read nothing into, as I think we said this previously, Epstein was charged with two counts. He was charged with conspiracy and sex trafficking under 18 U.S.C. 1591. Those and the specific indictment said with girls as young as 14, that hits subsection B2, which carries a mandatory minimum penalty of 10 years. So the crimes for which he was charged have the exact same statutory penalty as the Mann Act. The way in which we've gone through the federal sentencing guidelines, adding on additional counts would not have added them consecutively on to Epstein's sentences. But each individual, right, under the different theories, but each individual act with each individual girl could indeed be added on consecutively. So so there was no
unlike, they didn't need to do this. Is
they
what
didn't
you're
need
saying.
To. Unlike the Florida deal, right? The Florida deal was clearly politically, you know, sweetheart. We know that we've talked about that at some length. That's not what happened with the failure to charge Epstein under the Mann Act. And we don't need the catch-all Mann Act to cover child trafficking or sex trafficking. That is specifically codified at the sections that I talked about. I'm not a huge fan of the way the Mann Act has been deployed in our nation's history for the reasons that we've talked about. So nothing nefarious, a little bit of a story, a little bit of a dig at originalism, and I thought it was worth covering.
Yeah. Oh, nice deep dive. That was interesting. Definitely some disturbing history there, but I'm glad the Mann Act is less disturbing now and might actually be useful for stopping some really bad people. So that's good. Okay. So give us the details. I saw the news alerts on this and I knew you were going to talk about it. So give us the Andrew breakdown. What happened here?
So this arises out of the Oklahoma lawsuit that we discussed in episode 292. And, that case has gone to verdict. That was a bench trial, so no jury. Judge verdict against Johnson & Johnson for $572 million. In the immediate aftermath, the day after that verdict came out, Johnson & Johnson's stock went up. So some questions back and forth of, hey, why is this Johnson & Johnson? Is this too little? Was it right? And I want to disentangle all the parts of this lawsuit and explain what it means going forward. The stories, the new stories that you're alluding to, Thomas, are multiple reports that in light of this verdict, Purdue Pharma, which is responsible for OxyContin, right, which is the first domino that started the chain that led to the opioid crisis. We've talked about them at significant length in multiple episodes on the show. They have offered to settle the multi-district litigation, thousands of cases that are pending in Ohio for $10 to $12 million. For $10 to $12 billion, right. And the Sacklers divesting themselves of the ownership of Purdue Pharma. This has been described in various places as kind of an asbestos-style settlement. The idea is that then Purdue Pharma would be restructured, taken into bankruptcy, and restructured as a trust to pay out amounts owed to victims of the opioid crisis. I'm going to explain why they would make that offer in light of this verdict in a minute. I want to say the settlement also involves the Sacklers kicking in. So Purdue Pharma valued at $10 billion. The Sacklers would kick in $3 billion of their own money. The Sacklers collectively are estimated to have a total net worth of $13 billion. So $3 billion is a lot of money. Yeah. They still will have made, you know, inordinate gobs of money on wrecking rural America, basically. The notion, this does not really follow the tobacco settlement as much as it seems to me to be rather similar to the model in asbestos litigation. So at the time that asbestos litigation exploded, the Johns Manville Company was the worldwide leader in the manufacture of asbestos. They were essentially, Amalgamated Asbestos Company, Inc., right? Like if they'd been a 1910 company, you know, they would have been called Asbestox or whatever. Johns Manville manufactured most of the asbestos that was in use around the world. Once we realized that asbestos was very, very dangerous, it was clear Johns Manville was not going to continue as a company, that their liabilities would vastly exceed the company's assets. And so the company was taken into a Chapter 11 bankruptcy, restructured. They created the Johns Manville Trust, and all of the proceeds of the Johns Manville Corporation were then used to pay out asbestos claims. So that model, I think, is kind of what Purdue Pharma is anticipating with this proposed settlement, right? That they would be turned into a trust to pay out sums in connection with the opioid crisis. So that's your initial offer in settlement, right? We'll wreck the company and we'll kick in $3 billion. I think that helps indicate the significance of this Oklahoma verdict.
Yeah. So is the idea that like this is just one state. So if this could happen all over the country, you know, by the time it's all said and done, that's a lot of money. So therefore this was a good deal to them.
Well, it's that, and also this is the vindication of the public nuisance theory in Oklahoma. And so we discussed that briefly in 292. But this was not, right, a product defect, right? Like there are lots of potential claims that one might make against Purdue Pharma, right? You might make a strict products liability claim. Right. You sold a thing, OxyContin, that is as used, unreasonably dangerous. That certainly seems true, right? You, Purdue Pharma, engaged in deceptive marketing techniques that violate the uniform unfair marketing practices, right? And that, right? There are lots of things. Like if we sat here and brainstormed, we could probably come up with a dozen different torts that you could charge Purdue Pharma with. But the problem with all of those torts is that they require customer identification, right? If I want to say, hey, let's take this analogy into, let's say the power tools line, right? Like, I use a, I was going to say Black & Decker. I'll say Black & Decker. This is a hypothetical. Please, this is not meant to actually describe actual Black & Decker chainsaws, which I'm sure perfectly
we go,
safe.
We go DeWalt, we go Black & Decker, we got right. All kinds of options.
I use a Black & Decker chainsaw and I use it as intended. It throws off the chain and, you know, cuts off my arm, right? And then I sue Black & Decker under products liability, strict products liability. And I say, look, you made this unreasonably dangerous chainsaw and it had a defect. You're strictly liable for the fact that I've lost my arm. And, you know, I then prevail in that lawsuit. But crucial to that is I can only recover against Black & Decker if I can prove that it's a Black & Decker chainsaw, right? I couldn't recover against Black & Decker if I'm using a DeWalt chainsaw, right? That would make no sense. Now let's put that in the opioid context. If you take average person who is buying opioids off the street, right? Some who are using fake prescriptions, right, may know who manufactured the particular drugs that they've taken, but the vast majority are going to have problems identifying
right.
The manufacturer. And this is a case, right? I've talked about this in the past. There are lots of problems with this when you have an industry in which, you know, you have a major player, but you have other subsidiary players, right? And so, you know, if you try and aggregate together, quote, the opioid crisis, right? Then Purdue Pharma's lawyers, again, they would be, you know, they would be incompetent if they didn't do this, are going to say, okay, you can't bring this as a class action because we're only responsible for people who took Purdue Pharma products, right? If you didn't take OxyContin, we're not paying for that because we don't make the other stuff. The way around product ID, one of the ways around product ID is through a public nuisance theory, because what happens when you have a public nuisance is you are required to clean up the mess you caused, right? So, for example, public nuisance theory was used to varying effectiveness to deal with lead paint contamination in inner city, predominantly in poor inner city neighborhoods, right? And so the remedy that you got was, okay, get in and remediate. Take the paint off the walls and put a new non-lead-based paint up. And so you can use a market share allocation to determine how to come clean it up, right? If Sherwin-Williams sold 55% of the lead paint that was used in downtown Cleveland in 1950, then they just have to pay 55% of the costs of cleaning it up. Right?
Yeah, like, so it avoids, you don't have to figure out, oh, this specific house had this, so you got to go to them to get your money. It's just all right, we figured out roughly the percentages, and that'll somehow go into some sort of trust or whatever that'll pay out all these things.
Yep, that's exactly right. And because, again, you have a product ID problem, right? Because we know, you know, and the problem with lead paint is that lead paint flakes and children eat the lead paint and it causes brain damage, right? So we know that that happens, but, you know, I'm living in a house that has 1950s paint on the wall that's been sold four times, right? And the original owners are long dead. How do I prove if that's Sherwin-Williams paint or somebody else's paint, right? I don't have any idea. And so public nuisance enables you to avoid.
Find out.
Yeah. This has a bouquet of Sherwin-Williams.
On my brain.
But,
okay, this is definitely.
The back palate is bare. Right? You know, who knows, right? So so this case was a major case because, A, it was only brought under the public nuisance theory, and B, Purdue Pharma had settled out. They settled out for $280 million. And again, you might look at that and go, That seems like they got off pretty cheap. I would defend that settlement. I would defend the state of Oklahoma's settlement with Purdue Pharma because their lawyers had to take into account the likelihood that the judge would reject the theory and they'd get nothing. Right. Mm-hmm. So you price in the risk of loss when you're settling. So so I would, you know, in general, defend that settlement. But you were left then with a pretty aggressive theory in terms of recovery and not the primary defendant. Right. So Johnson & Johnson's pretty much their entire defense in this trial was, OK, A, public nuisance has to cover damage to property and, you know, creating the opioid crisis doesn't fit the definition of public nuisance under Oklahoma law. And B, to the extent that it does, hey, I mean, Purdue Pharma, they were the ones that were really awful. We're not. So that's a legally defensible argument to make, but they lost. And the judge specifically, and first he went through, and I'll upload this, it's 50 Oklahoma statutes sections 1 and 2 that define nuisance as any act that endangers the comfort, repose, health, or safety of others, and some other stuff. And a public nuisance affects at the same time an entire community or neighborhood or any considerable number of persons, although the extent of annoyance or damage inflicted upon the individuals may be unequal. And so the very first thing that the court said was, look, we get that public nuisance typically means damage to real property, but our law doesn't say that. So that the opioid crisis very clearly endangers the health or safety of others. So it counts. And by the way, even if it requires damage to property, there's ample evidence in the record that the opioid crisis has damaged an awful lot of property. So
how did it damage property?
Here's what the court says. They say the state has shown that the defendants have pervasively, systematically, and substantially used real and personal property, private and public, as well as the public roads, buildings, and the land of the state of Oklahoma in creating the opioid crisis. Right. So people who are strung out on opioids damage public property. Johnson and Johnson used public property, like their salesmen used the roads, right? Like this is, I will tell you,
but
yeah, J&J is going to appeal this verdict. It would not surprise me to see an appellate court. I haven't exhaustively reviewed Oklahoma law. It would not surprise me to see an appellate court, curtail that scope of the public nuisance theory, right? And say, hey, public nuisance theory does not require real property. To the extent that Oklahoma law requires a nexus to real property, this is too tenuous, right? It will be dicta, but that would still affirm the trial verdict, right? They would still say that this is endangering the health or safety of a large, considerable number of persons, which clearly is, right? And the court also rejected the marketing, right? J&J had argued, hey, look, like, you know, it's free speech. We, you know, described that. And the court said, no. Look, like, commercial marketing activities do not get you a First Amendment defense to public nuisance, which I think will stand on appeal. The reason that this is $572 million is because, as we've described, in public nuisance, you don't get damages, right? You don't get the recompense for the lives that have been wrecked. You get, right? And again, remember that usually we're talking about, you know, damage to property. You get go clean it up. And so beginning on page 30, there are 64 paragraphs of what clean it up, that legal term there being abatement, what it means in this context, right? So all of the different programs that that Johnson & Johnson is going to have to fund, treatment and other programs to try and do something to stem the tide of the opioid crisis in Oklahoma. So looking at that, it is instantly obvious now why Purdue Pharma wants to try and settle all of the claims now in perpetuity against the company, because Purdue Pharma is not going to survive as a company the next 5 years as a going concern outside of bankruptcy. The fact that a court has recognized this theory means that there will be parallel litigation across the country. And so we are going to see some kind of major, this is my prediction, that we're going to see some kind of major settlement beginning at their position. And again, remember, like, that was their initial offer was take the company into bankruptcy and take $3 billion of our assets, and we'll divest ourselves of any ownership and running the company, and we'll operate it as a trust to pay out for opioid victims. And by the way, we'll, you know, have made, you know, $10 billion, which is 11 figures. I mean, it's a number you can't even imagine.
All their wealth is from this? I mean, yep. Is there any reasonable yep. claim that, like, well, this is from our other businesses or something?
You know, who knows? But I mean, that I am sure that they have other assets and other investments. But yes, I mean, you know, it has come from operating Purdue Pharma. You know, we will see ultimately, but you know, there's not a whole lot more room to maneuver up at the top. And I think, ultimately, you know, the various states are going to, accept and structure some kind of settlement that says, all right, like, look, you know, we would love for you to go to jail and, you know, be like the Duke brothers at the end of Trading Places and, you know, have to be like living on the street over the flaming hobo barrel. That doesn't happen to white collar criminals in this country anymore. So, you know, they're
sense because they've killed. Would it be safe to say that it's possible they've killed more people than anyone ever, like in a
certainly than any serial killer, right? Like, the evidence, right? And we've talked about this, and we talked about the, you know, deliberate and deceptive marketing of OxyContin and sending their sales rep to tell doctors, no, you cannot prescribe higher doses of.
I'll correct myself. Short of maybe cigarette more
frequent,
companies.
I should say more frequent doses. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Short of cigarette companies and like the gun lobby. That would be the only other two
Look, this has, and again, this is an area, I mean, I said devastated rural America, like, you know, you've taken some comedic swipes at rural America on this show. We are liberal city dwellers. The opioid crisis in Trump's America, right, in red counties, in rural areas is devastating on a level that is hard empathetically to understand if, you know, you live in the, you know, the city in your
suburbs.
I don't
know that, is it divided that neatly? Because I feel like this affected just a lot of people.
Yeah.
Like, I know somebody who might have died from this.
Yeah. I don't mean to suggest it is confined to rural areas. I mean to say that it is, this is not an inner city problem. Right. This is
This is
pervasive throughout the
United
States.
This is pie in the sky. But is there any chance of getting after gun companies under the same logic, public nuisance logic, or is it already been tried?
There would be, except for the law that we talked about on the show
that protects them,
passed by Bernie Sanders that grants the gun industry immunity from those suits.
Well, that's great.
Yeah.
Cool.
And that was number one on the NRA's legislative agenda.
It really puts a new light on that debate back in 16. I'll admit I didn't know it was that big of a difference between the two candidates, but it actually was. And it sounds like that law was, not well understood by me at least, but maybe lots of voters.
Well, and again, I'm still losing more patrons for us. It is an illustration of the decorum and gentleness with which Hillary Clinton conducted the 2016 primaries. And I know our Bernie Sanders supporting people who are still mad and angry about it being stolen and Donna Brazile and the DNC and all of that. I am telling you, I'm older than you. I've seen through this. This is yet another piece of evidence that that it was a very, very mild, particularly from Clinton to Sanders, that by the standards of Democratic primary debates, it was very, very mild. This was something where she absolutely could have waged an unceasing campaign against Bernie Sanders and burned him to the ground. And she didn't do that. And she didn't do that because of the principle that we've tried to talk about, right? Which is, don't poison the well, right? Like,
yeah. I also think she felt like she had a handle on the on the nomination. That's part of it.
Yep, absolutely, absolutely. No, let me not ascribe overly, beneficent motives to Hillary Clinton, because she went much worse against Barack Obama in 2008. Yep. So absolutely, if she thought she was losing, I think she would have, poisoned the well and burned it to the ground. I don't mean to say that. I just mean to say that factually, she did not do that. Yeah. So
well, we're running out of
time. That's another way of saying get over it.
Yeah. We're running out of time. Anything else we need to cover on the opioid rulings, or are we looking for anything in the future?
Yeah, we are looking for a settlement, maybe even before this episode comes out.
Oh, wow.
And that's and that's why. And announced, right? It will take time to negotiate the details, but that's the model that it will follow. And it will follow that because once a court has said this is a viable theory, different states have different public nuisance laws, right? Like they're not uniform. This sits on top of the common law definition of public nuisance, but it will be tried in every state. Again, it will be tried because, you're talking about if you're a high-end plaintiff's contingency firm, right? Like that getting 33% to 40% of $572 million is pretty enticing. So there is a free market incentive for lots of lawyers to bring lots of lawsuits, and that will happen. Whether this will ultimately be a satisfactory conclusion, I suspect it won't be, right? Like the damage is beyond the capacity of the individual companies to repair. But we are at least moving towards doing something, and that's better than doing nothing.
All right. Well, just time for a quick third segment here. What did you want to say about that? I think Saba might have run some numbers for you on the Supreme Court decisions. I don't know if anybody else did.
So when we were talking about the Sheldon Whitehouse brief in episode 309, we kicked around some numbers, right, that were not otherwise present. And our amazing listeners with combinatorics backgrounds were able to run some of these. The having 4 out of 77 cases kind of randomly come up 5 to 4 meets with that. They did the math and it checks out, right? So exactly what you would expect in terms of there being a handful of 5-4 decisions that break down on what look like ideological lines, but for non-ideological reasons. The project, since we have so many fantastic math geeks who are also law geeks who listen to the show, the project that I would love to see that I think ought to be doable, that you can see breakdowns of Supreme Court alignments at SCOTUS blog. They go back more than a decade. My thesis is this, and it is the first half is pretty well established in the law review literature, that Supreme Court cases throughout our nation's history have had a reverse normal distribution, right? That is, they have predominantly been 9-0 decisions, and then kind of tailing off towards the 5-4, right? So that the average, sorry, not the average, I'm using the math term incorrectly here, but that from a from a modal standpoint, right? The mode of Supreme Court decisions has been 9-0. My thesis is that the distribution of Supreme Court decisions can be mathematically shown to have changed demonstrably, beginning in the 1980s and then beginning sharply with the Roberts Court in 2007. And I would love to see our listeners kind of tackle that project and show that that we have moved from a Supreme Court that has more 9-0 opinions to a Supreme Court that is pushing decisions towards the 5-4.
Yeah, based on this show, for the lifetime of the show, I don't even remember. I mean, maybe we don't talk about them. Maybe they're basic, you know, maybe they're obvious, but we don't often talk about 9-0 decisions. I mean, I can remember some 7-2 maybe, but yeah, if this show's any indication, there are a lot of not 9-0 decisions lately.
Yep. So, all right, math and law geeks.
So your thesis is it used to be the case that if you were to select a random decision from all of the decisions that had happened, odds were you'd get a 9-0. Is that what you're saying? Whereas
yes,
now,
and that is no longer
not,
the case.
Not the case. Okay, interesting. Be interesting to see some numbers to back that up. Thanks to all our listeners who are math geniuses and did this stuff. That's super cool. We love it. And you can find that in, I think, the Facebook group. Hop into the Facebook group if you aren't there. It's a fun place. Definitely search it out on Facebook. Okay, it is time to thank our new patrons at patreon.com/law. And I'll start us off here with Grant Bradley, Daryl Ross, Jay Clausen, and Raven's Angst. There we go. It's one word, yeah, but I think that's what it would be. Your turn.
And thank you to Cheapskate Clownhorn Patron, Cody P. Schaefer. Finish the back catalog. Time to start paying for Lord Awful Movies. Yes, nice. Indeed it is. Hope you enjoy it. And Robs, thank you all so much for supporting the show over at patreon.com/law.
All right, and now it's time to find out that I definitely got this question wrong. No question about that. Here we go, T3BE.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
Talk to the hand. I need your clothes. That's one of my mission parameters. Trust me. I know now why you cry.
Okay, so this question was about a law student in an apartment. Landlord says, hey, you know, I want some legal advice. Law student very intelligently and ethically says, dude, I can't help you with that. Landlord flips out, goes off the deep end, starts harassing him, calling him at home every evening, coming into the apartment when he's not there without his consent, when he's off at school, removing the handles from the bathroom faucets and the kitchen faucets. The question is, can he sue for trespass? You zigged when you wanted to zag and said no, because he has no standing to sue for trespass. I will tell you, you got the question wrong. That's not correct. Property, when one of the most important concepts about real property is that when you own a piece of real property, that is a bundle of rights, right? So think about it like, you know, 15 sticks that are kind of tied together. And you can transfer out property in fee simple, where you give the whole bundle of sticks away to somebody. Or you can transfer out just some of the sticks. Leasing a, you know, piece of real property to someone else is giving them one of the sticks. So they don't own the property, but they still have possessory rights because they've leased the property from you. So you absolutely have standing to sue for trespass because you're renting a piece of property.
All right. So my plan to pick the worst answer wasn't a good one.
That was not a great plan. Where would you have gone? You were so disappointed.
I'm just really beaten down by this bar. This was a tough question because I really I didn't know. I would say my next best guess, or my actual best guess, I mean, B is plausible. C and D, I can't find a big, especially since D contains C, sort of. I can't find a big reason for saying you could get injunction, punitive damages, or you could only get compensatory damages. I guess it would have been between D and B, and maybe I would have thought, okay, trespass does actually require some damage to property, so therefore B. I don't know. It's hard.
Yeah, well, it was. I thought you might say, since you were trying to do the George Costanza, like do the opposite of your instinct.
Yeah, well, that was what I was trying to do.
Right. Well, the opposite of A, right? No, you have no standing. In my view, is it yeah, you D. can sue for everything, right? Yeah, which would be yeah, D, right?
Sure.
Which is indeed the correct answer, okay. Right? So the
Andrew,
difference.
Andrew, who am I? I'm the opposite of every bar exam student you've ever met.
Who favorite are Seinfeld's. You, Thomas Smith? It's, oh my God, that so is good. Without a doubt. Yeah, that is the best episode ever. I total agreement. So yeah, no, this is a case where you have standing to sue. And then when the question is, what can you get in damages? Are you
not only yes,
to...
but hell yes, apparently.
Yeah. Hell yes. Right. Yeah. You damn hell ass kings. Yeah. Yes. You can get injunctive relief because, it's ongoing, yeah. And you can get compensatory damages for the damage to the property, and also as the bar exam is saying, I wouldn't have known this, for emotional distress, and for for the removal of the faucet handles. That makes sense. I would not have come up with that answer on my. I got to tell you that
I like how my answer I just did there would have been the thing I do every time, which is between B and D, and go with the wrong one. So I need to. I need to do that and then go with the other one that I don't. good time.
But what would have clued
B
me in?
Just because I still would have gotten it wrong, but it would fit with the pattern.
Yeah. What would have clued me in terms of getting the question is once you've decided that he does have standing and he's likely to prevail on the trespass claim, which is correct. Then the question is, can he get injunctive and punitive damages?
Yeah, that's
and
why
the fact
I would have
pattern
gone D
clearly
over C.
supports that. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. D
yeah.
over
I,
C.
I had that much. Sorry. I would have gone D over C, but I just got yeah. I don't know, because it's weird though, because he didn't. Yeah, okay. What's the question I'm remembering? Is there some other tort that's like trespass but involves property damage? Or
yeah.
There's something I'm
yeah,
remembering.
Look, there are a bunch of torts, right? That like the I don't know if you're thinking of sort of the difference between assault and battery, right? Where
no,
you know,
I swear there was some other bar question we had where there was some distinction between they went on the property, but it I don't know, and honestly, it sucks because that thing that I'm not remembering, had that not happened, I might have probably just gotten this right. But like, there's something going on. There's too much bad info in my mind that I couldn't remember.
Well, they do. Properly. Look, the bar does that, right? They load up questions. I mean, as you saw, right, there was the entirety of the like the legal advice and, you know, the calling him at home and the harassment that has nothing to do with the questions. Right. Like that's all just there to distract you. The fundamental question is, do you have standing to sue somebody else for trespass when you're renting the place and they do no damage to your personal property? And the answer to that is yes. So,
all right.
Sorry.
Yeah, no. That was all me. That wasn't even close. All right. I think we can officially say this is rock bottom. Maybe. I mean, I can always get worse. I guess I can get another one wrong. But maybe
in the opioid episode. I'm glad that you've admitted
you've hit
rock bottom.
I need to quit cold turkey, which is not as delicious as it sounds, and get back on the saddle and actually start getting some questions right, because this has been embarrassing. Okay, well, let's hop in our time machine and figure out who has not hit rock bottom like I have, clearly, and who's our big winner this week.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice...
Well, Thomas, not to pour salt into the wound or anything, but this week's winner is Kaylee on Twitter, who writes, for this week's T3BE, I'm going with D solely because it's the most wrong Thomas can possibly be. I'm sorry, and I'm sure Kaylee is sorry, but that was dead on and pretty funny, and everyone should give Kaylee a follow. That is at Quirk of Art XD, Quirk of Art XD on Twitter, and congratulations, Kaylee, on being this week's T3BE winner.
All right, thanks so much for listening. Thanks. I hope you're enjoying a lot of movies. The Q&A was so much fun, all that good stuff. be a patron. It's worthwhile. And we will see you on Friday.
You betray the law! Law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is a copyrighted production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. Opening Arguments is produced with the assistance of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, our transcriptionist, Heather Leverage, production assistant, Ashley Smith, and with the generous assistance of our volunteer unofficial researcher, Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our merch and our live shows and also heads up the OA Wiki project. Follow them at OA Wiki. And a big thank you to our Facebook group moderators, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian, and Teresa. Check out the Opening Arguments community on Facebook. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith for creating the fabulous OA theme song, which is used with permission.